This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Professor Stephen Millies of USC Aiken, and he has written a biography of Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, Seeking Common Ground. The Cardinal, as most of our listeners know, was a native of Columbia. So with that, Stephen, welcome to the Journal.
Thanks very much. It's delightful to be here.
And even though I say our listeners certainly have heard of the Cardinal, he's been gone for over a decade now, and some folks may not know his story. So let's do a little bit of background on him, if we would, please.
Sure. Well, in fact, we just had the 20th anniversary of his death in November. He died in November of 1996. And for me, it's hard to believe that's 20 years ago now, but it is. On the way in this morning, it was interesting. I drove past St. Peter's Catholic Church on the way here to talk to you today, a church where Cardinal Bernardin was baptized, confirmed, where his family worshiped throughout the youngest, most formative years of his life. His roots here so in Colombia are very deep. His mother lived here. His father and his brothers emigrated to this city from Italy. It's interesting, too, because if you go into St. Peter's here in Colombia, you'll find on the wall, as you walk into the church, two plaques. One, a quotation from Cardinal Bernardin about how close he still feels to this church. That was something he said in 1987, and it relates to a plaque that's on the opposite wall, which is a long quotation from a homily that Pope John Paul II gave when he came here to Colombia at Cardinal Bernardin's invitation in 1987 and visited that church. So throughout his life, Cardinal Bernardin remained very close to Colombia, very connected to the people who are here, to his past. He became a priest of the Diocese of Charleston in South Carolina in 1958. By 1966, he became the youngest Roman Catholic bishop in the United States, largely under the patronage of Paul Hallinan, who had been the bishop of Charleston, but had moved to be the Archbishop of Atlanta. Hallinan came home from his travels to Rome for the Second Vatican Council with what would ultimately be a fatal case of hepatitis that was diagnosed right around the time he moved to Atlanta. And so he requested that Bernardin come and help him, which he did until Hallinan died in 1968. From there, Bernardin's career goes on really to the highest levels of the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States of America from 1968 until 1972. He's the general secretary for the Conference of Catholic Bishops in Washington, D.C. Their job is to figure out how to implement the Second Vatican Council and everything it means for the church in the United States. Bernardin really, in an organizational sense, creates that bishops' conference as it still exists today. From there, in 1972, he goes on to be the Archbishop of Cincinnati, and in 1982, Pope John Paul II named him to be Archbishop of Chicago. In 1983, he was made a cardinal, and it's his ministry in Chicago, with its emphases on interreligious dialogue, on ecumenical dialogue, with its emphasis on what eventually would be called the consistent ethic of human life, and for his search for common ground inside the Catholic Church amid disputes inside the church that rose up after the Second Vatican Council. Those are the things that he's remembered for chiefly up until the time when he suffered cancer rather publicly in 1995 and 1996, ultimately leading to his death.
That is a real quick biography of the man. You're a political scientist by training. How did you get into writing this biography? I could say, having read it, it certainly involves church politics.
It does. Well, I guess the first thing I should say, and this probably is the question I get most often, the first thing I should say is my training's in political theory, which is different from political science and political theory. We read texts from Plato to Nietzsche and sort of talk about the why of politics rather than about the how. So we don't do public opinion polling or any of the sorts of institutional studies that you'd find in studies of American government, things like that. When you ask the questions about why in politics, you're inevitably going to be asking questions that involve history, philosophy, ethics, law, culture more broadly. So that's really where my interests always have been. In a particular way, I grew up in Chicago. I came to know who Cardinal Bernardin was as a young boy growing up there. And my interests have always traveled in the direction of how the Roman Catholic Church historically and today engages political problems. That's something I've been studying for 25 years now. One day, it just seemed like the most obvious thing to do, so far as I was here in South Carolina, so close to so many of the sources, and had gotten to know many people who knew Cardinal Bernardin. At the same time, I have friends and know people in Chicago as well, where a lot of the sources are too. Writing this book just became a very natural, and if I can say it, actually very easy thing to do.
Well, one thing I noticed as a historian getting into sources is that normally the Cardinal's papers would have been closed for a certain period of time, but you were allowed to get into them.
I was, both here in the Diocese of Charleston at the archives that are downtown on Broad Street in Charleston, and also most, in fact, I would say the overwhelming majority. It took some hunting to find them, actually, but the overwhelming majority of the Cardinal's papers are at the Cardinal Bernardin Archive and Records Center on Monroe Street in Chicago, and in both cases, particularly here, the personnel file for Father Bernardin from his time as a seminarian until the time that he left here would be closed forever, short of exceptions being made. Only portions of that were shown to me, but they were very helpful and very revealing. In Chicago, any archbishop's papers will be closed for 25 years as much to let memory and perspective sort of put things into a context as to give the archivists time to process what in Bernardin's case is really an extraordinary amount of documentation. That task still isn't done. They're still at work on it, even as close as we are to 25 years now. But there, too, they were good enough to let me look at a lot of the unprocessed materials. And again, as a study of Cardinal Bernardin's life, I've had the opportunity to see things that no one really has seen since the time he died. It really gave a lot to the book.
Well, let's just go back and start the story, the long version, if you will. Again, as a historian, I was particularly interested in his background as an Italian immigrant from Eastern Italy, Northeastern Italy, which was part of the Austrian Empire when his father and uncles immigrated. They were all stonemasons. Mm-hmm. At first, they immigrated to Vermont to work on granite. And then they ended up in South Carolina using Winnsboro blue granite as stonecutters.
I'm having trouble remembering as I'm sitting here because there were seven brothers, seven Bernardin brothers who emigrated from Tonadico di Primiero in northeastern Italy, as you say. They had learned the stonecutting trade there, and I guess in the waning days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire had sensed that there wasn't an awful lot of opportunity. At the same time, this was a period when lots of people from the southern reaches of Europe and the eastern reaches of Europe were coming to the United States looking for better opportunities. A member of the Bernardin family told me something very interesting, which was that they had no intention of coming here to stay, mm-hmm. that they had come here to make their fortune and bring it back home. But what wound up happening in the intervening years was the Great Depression and World War II. They had gone originally to Vermont and found that there wasn't quite as much opportunity there. They came to South Carolina. They did rather well, well enough that on their first trip back to Italy after the war was over, they realized not only had they been in the United States so long that they really were Americans, but it would be much better to be Americans at that point than it would to be Italians. So into that, you know, you have now Joseph Bernardin and his sister Elaine are born and are raised here in South Carolina, a part of the United States that did not see a lot of immigration during that period in the late 19th and early 20th
century. In fact, South Carolina
had
the lowest percentage of foreign-born residents of any state. And that right. continued to be true throughout until after World War II.
And it's very interesting. And this is something that the Bernardin himself talked a little bit about in public. It's very interesting to reflect on what role that had, not just being foreign-born, but being Catholic, having what was at that point very much a minority religious confession. At that point, I think less than 3% of the state. In fact, I want to say 1% of the state was Catholic.
I think it was 1% in his childhood.
And one thing that Bernardin said later on when he came to Chicago in a newspaper interview, I talked a little while ago about his lifelong interest in interreligious dialogue and ecumenical dialogue. He said that he and his sister and his cousins, they learned ecumenism early and they learned it naturally. I think very early in their lives, they realized they had a choice between being those children who came from those households where people spoke strange languages and cooked strange-smelling foods, or trying to reach out to people and to figure out how to close those gaps and become human to one another. I think that was what he was talking about, the way in which he had learned how to do that even from a very young boy.
Yes, a young boy who was raised by a widowed mother and an extended family. But there was something about the family background in Italy, that part of Italy that was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The town in which his father and uncles grew up, there were three languages spoken.
That's right. This was one of these places that was a crossroads of blowing borders and ethnicities throughout European history. As you say, at the time when the Bernadin brothers emigrated, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so I actually, you know, it's marvelous the things that you can do on the internet now. You can go and look at the naturalization papers and the immigration documents when people came to the United States at that time. Cardinal Bernadin, who was very much ethnically Italian, he and his mother spoke Italian, they cooked Italian foods, and yet one of his uncles identified his ethnicity as Hungarian, another as Magyar, another as German on these immigration papers. There's no question they were culturally Italian, but it also, I think, speaks to the idea that for the generation before Cardinal Bernadin, the Bernadins who had actually grown up in that place, they knew something too. They must have known something about trying to speak to people across divisions and a certain amount of comfort with difference.
When that first generation were coming, Italy was still, as a concept, was a very young sect. They were not living in Italy.
No, that's absolutely right. And even when we say that they spoke Italian, it's a dialect that we would recognize as Italian today. But you know, that's a more complicated picture, too.
All right. His father died, I think, when he was five or six.
Six.
And his sister had just been born.
That's right.
That situation, he really was raised by an extended family.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, shortly before he died, Cardinal Bernadin published a book. It came out after he died. Actually, he finished it just about 2 weeks before he died, called The Gift of Peace, published in 1997, which is as much a reflection on his ministry and on his long public battle with cancer that ends in his death. It's as much those things as it is a looking back on his whole life and on the experiences that brought him to where he was finally, this public figure dying so publicly, not just for Chicago, but for the nation and the world to watch. And his father plays a big role in that book. He talks about his awareness as a young boy that his father had been sick. He tells a story in that book about his father had had sarcomas, tumors of the soft tissue. He had had one removed from his shoulder. Bernadin remembers being maybe 3 or 4 years old and taking a fall and being terrified by the fall. He had fallen off a railing on a stoop or something like that. And his father runs to him and picks him up wearing a white shirt. And as he picks him up, Bernadin remembers he can see the blood soaking through from the bandages through the white shirt from the surgery. You can sort of imagine the effect that this has on the mind of a young boy. My father loves me so much. This must be very painful for him, yet he doesn't even seem to notice. And at the same time, too, his father is going back and forth to Providence Hospital for treatment here in Columbia. He's coming into regular contact with people, the sisters, certainly, but also doctors and nurses at the hospital.
The Sisters of Charity.
The Sisters of Charity, who have made choices in their lives to be helpers to people. Bernadin knew from a very young age, I think, that was what he had wanted. He had seen so much of it. It had affected him so deeply that eventually when he did enroll at the University of South Carolina, it was as a pre-med student.
But he stayed at Carolina for 1 year.
Just for 1 year.
By that time, he had determined what he wanted for his vocation.
Yeah, it's. I think it must have been with him sooner than that. But I think the picture that the documents and what he himself said about it seems to suggest that it may not have seemed like a very safe choice for him.
Well, his mother was not very. He was going to be a doctor.
That's right. He was going to make it.
He was going to make money.
Yeah.
And here he tells her as a teenager that he wants to become a priest.
Yeah.
I think you report a conversation he was having with a priest, and I think it was at St. Joseph's by this time.
The family had moved by then.
He said, my mother's opposed.
In fact, I'll come back for a moment to St. Peter's, and this is one of the reasons why I think it must have gone back earlier in his life than that first year at Carolina, because there was a story that was told, I talk about this in the book, where one morning after Mass, his mother let the pastor have it on the steps of the church, laid into him, yelling at him that he was trying to make her son become a priest. This was so unacceptable to her for all the reasons that you talk about. And one of the things that I try to be sure that we put a lot of light on in the book is the way in which we have to appreciate this from her point of view, that it's not only the immigrant's pride that we're going to come to the United States and we're going to be great Americans. But here again, as you say, you have a widow who's left in the depths of the Depression in 1934 with two small children, who's had a hard life and has had to work day in and day out. She worked as a seamstress, doing hard, close work with her hands, with her eyes. The idea then that her son might not be able to support her in her old age probably would have been terrifying for her from where she was and from how she saw the world. It certainly would have seemed improbable from where she was at that point in the 1950s. It should have seemed very strange to imagine that her son would become a cardinal archbishop, that he would be traveling the world as a global leader of political and religious opinion. And it leads actually to one story that I didn't put in the book just because you have to make choices about these things. But it came out of those documents that I was able to see when I saw Bernardin's priest personnel file here in the Diocese of Charleston. It was an exchange of letters with the bishop at that time, Bishop Walsh, the Bishop of Charleston. It seemed that young Mr. Bernardin had gone to have an interview to go to the seminary. This is just about a year before he entered the seminary. This is right around the time he's graduating from Columbia High School. He had gone and had an interview. It had gone well. And then he wrote back to Bishop Walsh and asked if he could postpone his admission. His mother wasn't quite ready yet. Could he postpone for about 6 months? And Bishop Walsh's secretary writes back and says, sure, that's fine. We're getting now close then to the passage of the 6 months, and another letter comes from young Mr. Bernardin to Bishop Walsh. This is now 1946, and young Mr. Bernardin writes that mother is still a little bit worried about my going to seminary. She's only heard during the war from her family by one letter that was delivered from the Red Cross, and we have no idea how anyone is doing. And then he says, you know, perhaps you could ask the apostolic delegate, Archbishop Sicignani, this is essentially the Vatican's ambassador to the United States. Perhaps you could ask Archbishop Sicignani if he could inquire into mother's family and find out how they're doing. You can imagine, you're smiling for the right reason.
I mean, yes, just go to the Vatican ambassador and find out about my family.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's the first response that he gets back from Bishop Walsh's secretary, something to the effect of, surely you must imagine both Bishop Walsh and Archbishop Sicignani have better things to do. Young Mr. Bernardin writes back one more time and says, this would really reassure mother, and I would so like to go to the seminary. We don't see anything back from there in the file that goes back to Mr. Bernardin, but we do see a letter that's there in the file making the inquiry to the apostolic delegate. At that point, the trail goes cold. We never find out whether the Vatican was able to track down Maria Bernardin's family there in northeastern Italy. But I think there you get a picture of a lot of things all at once. Certainly the desire of Bishop Walsh to get and hold on to this apparently very talented young man to be a seminarian. You also get a window into the dynamics between Joseph Bernardin and his mother, which remains a close relationship until the day he dies. She outlived him. And then finally, too, I think you begin to understand even more what motivates his mother, this concern for her son, for her family. But maybe part of what soothes her is the idea that though he might be poor as a priest, look at the kind of influence he's able to wield through the church to even get this most important piece of information for her about how her family has done after the war.
All right. And so he spends one year as a pre-med student at the University of South Carolina here in Columbia. And then he goes off to seminary in Kentucky.
Right.
And I guess when people think about going to graduate school, that the student would select, but in this case, the bishop selects. Is that still the case in the church?
It is. And I'll say this. A very good friend of mine is a priest here in Charleston, about as old as Bernardin. And he likes to joke he was at St. Mary's, Kentucky as well. I don't know whether this is true, but he likes to joke that it was subsequently sold by the church and it became a prison, so that now it's only a little bit less strict.
Well, you said that this particular seminary was chosen because as a child he did not take Latin. Let our listeners know why that was still important back in 1947.
Well, this is a long time before the Second Vatican Council at this point. Up to that point, and since the Council of Trent in the 16th century, following the Reformation, the Mass was celebrated everywhere in the world in Latin. And I should say, too, for those who don't know, celebrated ad orientem, which is to say the priest faced toward the east, toward the altar, with his back to the people assembled in the congregation, who were there to pray. pray, but who were there largely as spectators. The most important liturgical innovation of the Second Vatican Council in the way that the Mass is celebrated was not only to turn the priest around to face the people so that the priest and the people together are engaged in a common enterprise around the altar table, but also it permitted the Mass to be offered in the languages spoken by people where they lived. No one had any idea of this at the time when Joseph Bernardin went to the seminary, and at that point it only seemed reasonable. He would have to have enough Latin to be able at least to read the Mass fluently, better still to be able to read some of the theology surrounding the Mass as well, too.
And how many years was he in seminary?
Oh, gosh, off the top of my head, I want to say he was there. He completed an undergraduate degree, and then he went on and did graduate work at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., all told.
And he actually got his graduate degree in education.
That's right, and that was his request. He had sought permission to do that. And the earliest years of his priesthood, split between Columbia and Charleston, were in teaching in high schools and youth ministry and that sort of thing. It really sort of seemed to be where he imagined his life was going to go.
So he was based in Columbia.
That's right.
But he's teaching at Bishop Eglin High School in Charleston.
Yeah. And that was a strange sort of business that struck me rather strange. It's a bit of speculation on my part, but it's easy to imagine in those days, St. Joseph's in Columbia would have had more than enough young priests and a pastor to make sure that the needs of that parish were attended to throughout the course of a Monday through Friday week, and would only have maybe needed Father Bernardin's services during the weekends when things picked up, so that he would have been free to drive down to Charleston through the week and then be back in Columbia on the weekend to celebrate Mass.
The priest at St. Joseph's requested him once he was ordained. And when was he ordained?
I said 1958 before, but I think it was 1952.
Okay.
I misspoke before. It was 1952 he was ordained. And at that point, the Bernardins had been in St. Joseph's. The pastor there had been eagerly seeking not just to get Father Bernardin assigned to St. Joseph's, but had also wanted to make sure that the ordination would take place there. And even today, finding suitable places to ordain priests in the Diocese of Charleston, sometimes they're had here in Columbia, sometimes they're had other places, just simply because the diocese is so large. Its enormous size sort of sometimes makes it difficult for people to get from every corner of the state to important events. But at that time, the closeness of the pastor to the family, I think, probably accounted for most of that. That and knowing, again, that they were talking about a very talented young man.
I just found it interesting that the priest at St. Joseph's was basically dickering with the bishop to make sure that the ordination happened at Columbia.
Well, I think it's one of those things, and you'll know that this is one of the wonderful things that happens when you get an opportunity to go into the archive and go into the documents, is that all of the draperies are sort of swept aside, mm-hmm. and you really have an opportunity to watch and see how people interact with each other. It's always very illuminating, and there's no doing anything like a project like this that's really worth doing it without going back and looking at those original sources. And one of the things, I mean, I think it makes a certain amount of sense if we stop and think about it, but we don't normally stop and think that working in the church or working in any religious organization, or for that matter, working in a university or a hospital or any of these other great institutions that play important roles in our life, that's important work, and it's work that helps us and helps other people. But at a certain point, it's just another workplace. And there are complicated relationships that unfold between, well, what is in a sense supervisors and the supervised. I don't want to quite say employees. That doesn't capture the relationship, but it's as true between a bishop and a pastor as it is true between a pastor and the priests who are working in that church. You get a glimpse of that.
And I want to get back to that later on, because when the church began to face difficulties with sexual abuse cases, mm-hmm. Bernardin noted that the bishop was no longer the chief pastor as much as he was the supervisor.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always an element, and that's important too. There's always an element of the relationship between, and this is again something that lay people don't think about, an element of the relationship between a bishop and the priests, that the bishop is a sort of a spiritual older brother. There's supposed to be a kind of a close, intimate relationship there. And one of the consequences of the sexual abuse scandal has been the necessity to really, as you say, delve a little bit more into a legally protected employer-employee type relationship.
Stephen, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Stephen Millies of USC Aiken about his biography of Columbia native Cardinal Joseph Bernardin. Stephen, we've got the cardinal here in Columbia as a young priest. He's also working in Charleston. And then he ends up in diocesan headquarters in Charleston. How did that come about?
It's a little unclear exactly, except that it had to have come about as a consequence of the time he was spending commuting between Columbia and Charleston. He was in residence across the street from the cathedral on Broad Street, and probably just through the course of being at the dinner table and sitting around in armchairs in the evening, came to know the priests who were working there and came to know the bishop better.
And that was Bishop Russell at the time.
That was Bishop Russell at that time, that's right, who, and this is an important part of the story, left not all that long after that. But before he left, he did manage to bring Father Bernardine down to Charleston and put him into the first of what would eventually be many, many administrative roles in the Diocese of Charleston.
All right. I think explaining those different roles for non-Catholics, they might not understand exactly what authority that gave this young man.
In many ways, it was rather extraordinary. He was it's a complicated sequence of successions, and he held many offices at the same time during periods of time, too. But the first one he held, I believe, was vice chancellor for the Diocese of Charleston, although a short while after that, he became chancellor. The way the lines of authority typically work is certainly the bishop is in charge. There's no question about that, both as a matter of canon law and as a matter of civil law. The bishop is the owner of the corporation, to say nothing of the fact that spiritually he has the other privileges as well. The bishop plays three roles, to teach, to sanctify, and to govern. But the idea is that the bishop should spend some time teaching and sanctifying. And so for that, in the ordinary organization of things, the bishop has an official called the vicar general. Bernardine eventually would become vicar general of the Charleston diocese as well. So the vicar general sort of functions as a chief executive officer underneath a sort of a chairman of the board, if we want to think about it that way, as the bishop. The chancellor functions as sort of a chief operating officer. So, for example, when the records had to be opened to me in order to do research for the book, I was dealing with the chancellor of the Diocese of Charleston and the chancellor of the Archdiocese of Chicago. These are the people who are on the ground really making the decisions and making things work. But at different times, Bernardine was one of my favorite jobs that he had, one of the most revealing exchanges of letters I read was his time as the director of Catholic cemeteries for the Diocese of Charleston. You don't go into the archive thinking that's going to be the most fascinating folder that you're going to open, but it winds up there.
I'm waiting to hear the end of this story.
Go on. Well, it's, it really is. There was a scandal at the Vatican Bank at the end of the 1970s, and there was an Archbishop, Paul Marcinkus, who was in charge of the Vatican Bank at that point. And in the midst of what looked like a lot of shady financial dealings, Archbishop Marcinkus said something that I've always thought was actually rather true. He said that you can't run the church on Hail Marys. And, you know, as much as we might want to say, well, in the midst of a scandal, maybe that doesn't sound quite like the right thing to say, it nevertheless remains true. Somebody's got to make sure the bank account is full. Somebody's got to make sure that the Catholic hospitals have enough money to pay their staff and they can afford to buy medicine from pharmaceutical companies. And somebody's got to be able to pay the grave diggers and the people who provide the care at the cemetery, too. This was an important part, I think, of the education of Cardinal Bernardine to be Cardinal Bernardine. It's one thing to have a certain amount of intellectual ability to get good grades in the seminary. It's another thing to be able to process the paperwork. But finally, ultimately, being bishop or being archbishop of a large American archdiocese like any multi-million-dollar corporation is going to require you to make difficult decisions. One of the really fascinating things about the cemetery file was watching him get more comfortable saying no to people, because it certainly was the case that there were not at that time, nor are there really today, a lot of Catholic cemeteries in the state of South Carolina. The church really still today is quite firm that Catholics should be buried in the sanctified ground of a Catholic cemetery, except in the exceptional cases for a serious reason. As the director of Catholic cemeteries, he would get these letters all the time. You know, we'd like to have someone buried somewhere outside a Catholic cemetery. It's just such a long drive from where we are to visit them. And the letters are, you know, sort of, well, we understand, well, we understand. Interspersed with the letters are financial reports for Catholic cemeteries, and they're not good. And you can sort of see the letters are getting tougher as the financial picture is getting bleaker. And again, you know, maybe it's tempting to say, oh, he's being hard-hearted. It's all just about money after all. But on some level, when you're responsible for it, of course it's about money, because you've got to make sure that you're able to pay the gravediggers and you're able to provide the care of the cemeteries and everything else. Being a bishop, like being a professor, like being a university administrator or the head of a company, requires saying difficult no's to people. And Bernardin learned to do that, I think, strangely of all places, being the director of cemeteries for the Diocese of Charleston.
Stephen, I love this background, but
sure,
we've got to get this Columbia boy to Chicago.
It's both a short trip and a long trip. One person we haven't talked about yet that I should say a few words about is Paul Hallinan, who came after Bishop Russell. Hallinan hadn't expected to become a bishop. He'd been doing Newman Club, National Newman Club, which is a sort of youth ministry for Catholic college students. He'd been in Ohio. In a lot of ways, he had a kind of a similar background to Bernardin. And when Hallinan, to his surprise, came to Charleston as bishop, he and Bernardin hit it off instantly. This was 1958, I think. This was really at the moment when Bernardin, as a young man, had realized he had a gift for church administration. Hallinan realized it immediately, too. As I say, Hallinan was only here a very short while. He was only here until 1962 or 63, if I remember correctly, 63. And then he was off for Atlanta. By that time, Bernardin again is rising. This is the period of time where he becomes the administrator of the Diocese of Charleston, ruling between bishops, running the diocese between bishops until the Vatican names a new one. But Hallinan spots his talent, takes him along to Atlanta because of his illness. And then once Hallinan dies in 1968, Bernardin is off to Washington, D.C., then on to become the Archbishop of Cincinnati, a large archdiocese, a very Catholic part of the United States, the state of Ohio, one of the largest Polish populations in the United States.
Where he makes an important connection.
Yeah, this leads him to get to know Archbishop Karol Wojtyła, the Archbishop of Krakow. Bernardin makes a trip to Krakow in 1976. Wojtyła reciprocates, comes to the United States. And then in 1978, Wojtyła is named Pope John Paul II. 5 years later, Bernardin is in Chicago. John Paul has appointed him there. And less than a year later, John Paul names Bernardin to the College of Cardinals, really makes him one of the most important churchmen in the United States and the world.
John Paul II was considered a relatively conservative wing of the Catholic Church. Bernardin is very clearly Vatican II, the more progressive wing of the Catholic Church. So his appointment to Chicago, which many consider one of the most important, if not the most important diocese, and we can argue L.A. and New York, but clearly it was a very important diocese. But for John Paul to choose someone who was not from his part of the church, most of the other archbishops and cardinals he named were from that more conservative part of the church. But yet he appoints this bright, young, progressive to one of the most important dioceses in the United States.
Yeah. We started off talking a little bit about politics and my study of politics, and I think that one of the things that I would hope a reader of this book comes away with is a sense of how poor those political labels, liberal and conservative, are when we talk about things inside the church. And I would say parenthetically, as a political theorist, I don't think they help us much talking about American politics either. But the relationship between John Paul and Cardinal Bernardin is one that I think discloses to us what some of the problems with thinking about people just in terms of those labels really is. First of all, you know, let's just take Cardinal Bernardin, who throughout the 1980s and the 1990s tries to come up with a way to talk about issues like abortion and euthanasia and bioethical issues to communicate the church's message, the teachings of the Catholic Church, to a non-Catholic American political audience, trying to find a way to communicate those. Eventually, those are called the consistent ethic of human life. Some people call it the seamless garment. But his positions on all of those issues, of course, are what we would call the very conservative positions of the church. The very important ways we have to talk about Bernardin as being a conservative. On the other side of it, if we take a look at John Paul II, here is someone in his opposition to Soviet communism and the Soviet domination of Poland who from their point of view appears to be a bit of a liberal radical for the way that he's holding on to the church. It's important to remember, too, that Bishop and eventually Archbishop Wojtyła at the Second Vatican Council, when he was younger, Pope John Paul II was regarded as one of the leading council liberals. Mm-hmm. These labels are always a matter of perspective. And if Cardinal Bernardin's life was about anything, it was about trying to overcome the blinders that we put on when we start looking at people through those labels. There's a real relationship here between these two men. One of the most, you talk about the appointment of Bernardin to Chicago, but the real story after there's a false allegation against Cardinal Bernardin of sexual abuse in 1993, and Bernardin is cleared. I can remember one of the Cardinal's priest assistants telling me the story. I had read in the news that he had gotten this phone call, and this was in the days before popes used to telephone people, as the current pope does. But the call came through from the Vatican when Cardinal Bernardin was vindicated. Someone said the pope is on the phone, and his first reaction was, oh, right. But it actually was. Pope John Paul called him on the phone, a fairly extraordinary thing, to tell him how relieved he was that this was over. Those two men had met each other almost 20 years before that, and they retained, I think, a real bond of trust and friendship in the roles that they both were playing that gets beyond the liberal-conservative divide.
I found it fascinating, as you discussed, Vatican II, and clearly Bernardin was part of that group that was trying to bring some fresh air into the mm-hmm. church, and the pushback he began to get that got pretty nasty personally. Yeah. There was a meeting in Rome where people left a newspaper on his chair that was critical of him, and that was a violation of all sorts of protocol.
Yeah, one of the things I think when we do talk about this division in the church that Bernardin in the last years of his life really tried to overcome by launching his Catholic Common Ground initiative, somewhat unsuccessfully, I'd have to say, from our perspective where we are today. But one of the things I think we have to take note of when we talk about this is that what's happening in the church in terms of the differences that spring up about implementing the Second Vatican Council doesn't happen in a vacuum. And indeed, you know, some of the council liberals who had names like Wojtyła or Ratzinger, who would go on to be Pope Benedict XVI, these are men who are living in Europe after the council, during the late 1960s, when students are taking to the streets, when there's violence and protest, and they find what's going on in the world around them a little bit terrifying. And here in the United States, we experience some of that too. In 1973, the Supreme Court decides Roe versus Wade, and I think it's not only a Catholic phenomenon. In fact, I'm certain that it's not, that people begin to feel as though there are two sides of a culture war as the 1970s become the 1980s and the 1990s. We polarize really to this point where we are today. This happens within the church, but it's also, like everything else, a thing that happens to the church because it's happening in the larger world all around us. And so we do see this nastiness creep in, for example, to the treatment of somebody like Cardinal Bernardin, who's trying to look past those differences and build bridges in a way that he had since the time he was a boy in Colombia, trying to say, can't we all just talk to one another about the things that we think are important, both with some people in Rome, not Pope John Paul, I would say, not Pope Benedict later either, but certainly with some people in Rome, as well as some bishops and many Catholics here in the United States, they wind up feeling so strongly about that culture war that they wind up doing some things that seem rather strange from a perspective of Catholic or, for that matter, Christian or any religious faith.
There were those who really did not want him. His idea of, can't we all get together, the ecumenical, that hit a wall as well.
Of course, that's always a complicated thing to undertake, dialogue among faiths, because you're in a way beginning from disagreement. Mm-hmm. You have your tradition, I have my tradition. And that can go two ways. It can either go in a kind of a wishy-washy, let's try to pretend there are no differences sort of direction. And I don't know that that's very helpful because it means somehow I've now got to be less authentic and so do you. The other way is to acknowledge the differences and try to engage in a dialogue with those differences. That's very challenging, to try to hold the idea in my head on the one side that I believe something very different from what you believe, but you might have something to teach me. That's hard. And that's why that process still goes on today.
I think you used the phrase, and I'm going to read here, as the 80s faded into the 90s, Rome's esteem for Joseph seemed suddenly to ebb. Some of the officials in Vatican offices had begun to fear Joseph's influence had grown too great, and several appointments of new bishops in the United States were much different sorts of personalities, more eager to confront secular culture than to reach out to it.
Yeah. And again, there had to be a pool of those bishops to find people to appoint. They had to be available. And again, I think, you know, that's the fruit of what's happening in the church and outside the church. It's also true, though, that organizationally, it has to be appreciated that to say John Paul did this or John Paul did that is no more easy than it would be to say about a president or a governor. Or there are staffs, there are bureaucracies. Within the Catholic Church, it would probably be a little bit more accurate to say that the role that the apostolic delegate, the Pope's representative to the United States, plays in the selection of bishops is probably where you want to keep your eye. And it's rather ordinary to talk about Jadot bishops versus Lagy bishops. In 1984, there was a transition from Archbishop Jean Jadot, who was known for choosing these somewhat more liberal bishops, and Archbishop Pio Laghi, who replaced him in 1984, who was known for choosing somewhat more conservative bishops. Jadot had been selected by Paul VI before John Paul ever got there. John Paul appointed Laghi, but it's fair to say that there's more than just one person sitting in Rome deciding who these bishops are going to be. There's a larger cultural change that's underway, in other words.
Towards the end of his life, he's still in Chicago, when he was working on a publication.
This was the statement called to be Catholic that announced the Catholic Common Ground Initiative.
He let his fellow bishops look at it. Nobody said anything. And then when it came out, they condemned it.
Yeah, this was maybe the most extraordinary thing that happened during his life. Certainly from his point of view, I think he would have said that. What was happening was in 1992, this is 4 years before he died, there had been a study done by the National Pastoral Life Center that had found that parishes, local churches around the United States, were increasingly polarized. People weren't talking to each other over political things, over how the Mass was celebrated, all of this stuff that came after the Second Vatican Council. This started a conversation that brought in Cardinal Bernardin and brought him to a point in August of 1996, now 3 months before he died, where he announced the Catholic Common Ground Initiative, where he invited leaders of the Catholic Church in the United States from both the so-called left and the so-called right to engage in an ongoing process of dialogue that I should say still goes on today at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, Illinois, where the Catholic Common Ground Initiative is headquartered. Bernardin and these influential Catholics had put together a statement called Called to be Catholic, Church in a Time of Peril, identifying polarization as a crisis in the church and urging everybody to join together to try to enter into some dialogue about it. And as you say, Bernardin, and this was very typical for him, he never blindsided anybody. He was a paperwork person. He believed in process. He was an administrator down to his bones. So he circulated copies of the statement privately to at least the cardinals, the other cardinals in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, other places. And none had had a problem with it. The statement came out, and immediately came the press releases from those other cardinals. It had never happened before that an American cardinal had been attacked so publicly by his fellow cardinals in the United States, and attacked simply for calling for dialogue. In fact, the Archbishop of Boston had said that dialogue between truth and error is an exercise in mutual deception. I think I'm getting that right. There's no possibility of dialogue from his point of view with someone who's just plain wrong. I talked to a lot of people who worked for Cardinal Bernardin at that time, and what they told me was that the false allegation of sexual abuse had hurt him deeply and the cancer terrified him. But the thing that bothered him the most when he died was that his fellow cardinals had done that.
In the light of the history that happened since his death, it's kind of ironic that those who attacked him the most have been the cardinals who have overseen some of the worst incidents dealing with sexual abuse in the United States.
Yeah, there's a, you know, maybe even a little bit more to it than that. I think I tread very carefully on this in the book because Bernardin is in Chicago when the first real indications become public that there's a sexual abuse crisis inside the church. It had come out at a parish where there had been a priest who was accused of abusing a young person, that he had been transferred from another parish where he had done it before, and the parish flew into an outrage. And Bernardin was sensitive enough to recognize based on the new information that was coming in, that the people in that parish were right. And Bernardin undertook a review of how the Archdiocese of Chicago dealt with those cases. Chicago was the first archdiocese in the United States to require reporting every allegation of abuse to the police. First one to do it. There were a couple of other dioceses that were out front too, but Chicago really was the only big one. Bernardin, being a person who had spent a lot of his time working to build up the National Bishops' Conference, tried to share the Chicago model with the other bishops of the United States at that time in 1991-92 as a means of trying to change how the whole church in the United States dealt with that problem. He was dismissed and sent away. And in fact, I quote one of those bishops in the book who called it a Chicago problem. The terrible irony of that is that it was the Archbishop of Boston who was so dismissive about it, who 10 years later would be involved in a horrible scandal there and would have to resign. What's important for us here is here again, as you point out, the terrible irony of it. Here's Cardinal Bernardin, who's listening to the people in that parish in Chicago, is recognizing that a change needs to be made. I have to say, those bishops who wanted to resist the change, you have to understand from their point of view, we talked about before as well, the way in which the relationship, the personal relationship between bishops and priests is going to have to change. Lots of things are going to have to change inside the church. That's difficult and maybe even frightening for people to imagine. Bernardin tried to be a leader on that. Like his leadership on dialogue and common ground, it was not greeted very receptively. And in both cases, I think the church has really not been better off for not having heeded him.
You mentioned the relationship between bishop and priest. It becomes more legalistic, and Bernardin recognized that. He also regretted it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because it isolated him. It had to. To have now this separation introduced, this legal separation, that this distance that has to be introduced into the relationship, you'd have to imagine is very difficult for them.
Stephen, let's move on to the Cardinal's last year and his openness in dealing with his cancer and then his final publication, his gift.
Yeah. You know, one of the Cardinal's priest assistants told me that there were only two things that he was really terrified of, that he would face an allegation of abuse and that he would get cancer, as his father had died of cancer. And one happened and then the other happened. And it's easy to imagine. I think we all have our own worst fears, the things that haunt us, that we worry about in those minutes before we fall asleep, that could happen and we'd feel some loss of control in our lives or not know what the future holds. In very quick succession, he faced both of those things. Between 1993 and 1996, he went from that allegation of abuse. In 1995, he had had some signs show up that something wasn't quite right and had seen his doctor, who immediately recognized he had a tumor on his pancreas. There was a successful surgery that they were able to remove. The cancer went away for a bit. But then he also began experiencing other health problems because of the cancer treatment, most particularly a very painful spinal stenosis from the radiation. So his bones were weak. He had a couple of fractures and took some falls. So, I mean, all of that was kind of awful. Finally, then eventually came the final diagnosis in 1996 that the cancer was back, and this time there was nothing that they could do about it. And here again, I tell the story in the book, one of his closest assistants, Father Ken Velo, was in the car with him on the drive back from the hospital. And he said they were quiet for just a bit. And then Bernardin got on the phone and started telling people, calling people so they wouldn't hear it on the news, including calling Father Velo's own family that he had just spent Christmas with. What was striking about it for Velo and for a lot of the people who saw it and experienced it, either knowing him or on television, was how apparently easily Bernardin had adjusted himself to the idea of his death. He had accepted it. I think we want to be careful about this, that we don't want to say that it was easy. Bernardin liked to say, he liked to quote the spiritual writer Henri Nouwen, who said that we all need to learn to think of death as a friend. This isn't to say that, you know, we should look forward to it. This isn't to say that it's not going to be painful. It certainly was painful, and I'm confident it must have been as frightening for Bernardin as for anybody else. But even if we're not people of faith, we recognize this is going to be a part of our life. It's going to happen to all of us. If we are people of faith, of course, it's got an even deeper dimension, that this is a transition in our life to something that might come afterwards. And so in all of those ways, Bernardin, I think, recognized that the false allegation of sexual abuse in 1993 and the complete vindication that followed it had really given him a kind of a liberation, a freedom to be himself publicly that no one had ever seen him have before, to get a little bit away from the administration and the paperwork and get out with people and smile a little bit more and laugh a little bit more. The cancer liberated him in a different way, if not the first time, then certainly the second time, liberated him to be very open about his illness and everything that it would mean, but also to try to give, as you say, this last gift to the church and really to everyone, Catholic or non-Catholic, to give this gift to say that we live our lives towards something. And if we're young, we live them toward being middle-aged. If we're middle-aged, we live them toward being older. But regardless of where we are in our lives, we all live toward an end. Our lives aim at something. If we believe in something after that, then we have that to look forward to as well. But Bernardin finally emerges at the end of his life as a figure who offers us hope and offers us peace. That's the title of his last book, The Gift of Peace, gives the church and everyone who reads it this gift of understanding. If we accept the reality of our lives, that we live and hopefully we live for something, and that this ending is natural and it's coming and we need to live every day that way, then maybe it's not so frightening and we can think of it as a friend that accompanies us through our lives every day to remind us to make each day matter.
Professor Stephen Millies, author of Joseph Bernardin, Seeking Common Ground, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. This little book is a story not just of the cardinal, but also really of the developments within the Roman Catholic Church between 1970 and the turn of the century, and also of American society. As a historian, what was fascinating to me, besides the content of the book, is the fact that Professor Millies had access to private church archives unavailable to anyone else. And that makes this book unique. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.